In our prayer with Rocky, we talked about God's promise of blessing to Abraham and through Abraham, that Abrahamic covenant. And so we started looking at that way back in chapter 12. We saw it again referred to in chapter 13. We saw it enlarged upon in chapter 15. And then again in chapter 17, the sign of circumcision was given. And then in chapter 22, at the birth of Isaac. Here we are in chapter 26. And you'll note down in verse 3, again we have it. But now it's being spoken to Isaac, Abraham's son. And when we get to Jacob, Isaac's son, we'll see this covenant again. And so it runs all the way through the book of Genesis. It prepares the way for the book of Exodus. The children of Israel were in Egypt. And what was their fate had God not intervened?
Probably extinction.
Extinction. Because all the male boys were being killed. And so God intervenes in a very special way for one special nation for a very special purpose. And they're brought out of Egypt. But all of that, you're reading in Exodus, begins back in Genesis 12. And throughout these promises to make of Abraham a great nation, whose seed could not be counted. That's repeated to Isaac and it's repeated to Jacob. But at the time that we're going to read in Genesis, in just a few chapters more, even Jacob and his boys were getting in very desperate straits because of a famine. And once again, we're going to see the providence of God that Rocky made reference to in his prayer because of the events surrounding Joseph. And so as we go through the book of Genesis, we get into the book of Exodus, and we see these things developing. Remember this promise in Genesis 12. That third part of that promise, of course, lays the foundation for the rest of the Bible. In you, or in your seed, chapter 22, all nations of the earth will be blessed. There was a promise to his seed, and there was a promise through his seed. And so that covenant promise to Abraham is very foundational. So here we are in chapter 26 in our study tonight. We have on the outline Isaac in the land of the Philistines. And we have mentioned in previous classes, later on in the time of the nation being in the land of Canaan after they were delivered, they had conflict with the Philistines, and battles with the Philistines. Well, here again is some background data as to their interaction back in the time of the patriarchs. And so there's a famine in the land besides the previous famine that occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you." Now, Abraham went to Egypt when there was a famine, didn't he? And when he went to Egypt, what did he do, Abraham? Lied about his wife. That's right. Was deceptive about Sarah. I don't know why God told Isaac not to go unless he was trying to avert that. I don't know. Maybe there's other reasons. The text doesn't tell us. But the fact is that did not keep Isaac from walking in the steps of his father. We'll see that a little later. But nevertheless, verse 3, "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you." Now, to give to your descendants, I will give all these lands. Okay, so I will be with you and bless you. Now, if God's going to be with him and bless him, and remember, this is a time when God is blessing them not only spiritually, but physically. Would there be any reason for him to fear the king of the Philistines?
No.
No. And so while Abraham's a man of faith and Isaac's a man of faith, we're going to see that sometimes their faith had weaknesses. We'll see that again with Isaac as we did with Abraham. We're looking back and we can say, look, God said, I'll bless you. That ought to take care of these issues that arise. And it's easy to sit and critique Abraham and Isaac, but what about you and me? We're also promised, for example, Jesus said, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be added to you. Do we trust that enough to where it reflects the choices we make in life about our jobs and our time and etc.? So, good lessons for us. So, anyway, he said, I will be with you and bless you, and to you and your descendants. And by the way, I'll be with you is not talking about literally that God would walk by his side, but the idea of his relationship with Isaac that would provide this protection and blessing that he's talking about. We use it that way today. We ask God to be with us or in our midst. And he said, to you and your, this version says descendants, but you'll note when you run across that in the New American Standard, there'll be a little number. And out in the margin, it'll say seed. The word seed is singular, but it can be used collectively. That is to collect people. And your seed would be your descendants. And so the translators, instead of just translating seed, they put the word descendant, but it's seed. To your seed, I will give all these lands. Now, down on your questions on this lesson, we ask, what are the three parts of the Abrahamic covenant confirmed to Isaac? So what's the first part of the Abrahamic covenant that's confirmed to Isaac?
He said, under thy seed, I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham your father.
Okay, so it's the land part of the promise, right? I'm going to give this land. So, Abraham didn't own any that God gave him when he died, and God didn't give Isaac any either. But the promise was to their seed or descendants, a land promise. Okay, and then, verse 4, what's the second part of the promise?
A great nation.
A great nation. And he uses this phrase here, and it's used in other places. I'll multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven. Some places says it'll be like the dust of the earth, or you won't be able to count them. There'll be so many. That's certainly not true at this time, is there? How many boys did Isaac have?
Two
boys. And yet he said, your seed will be so many, you can't even count them. And so there's going to be a great nation. And then, at the end of verse 4, you have the third part of that Abrahamic covenant. He said, by your descendants, or in your descendants, or in your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And so we have Peter, in Acts 3, preaching to that Jewish audience and making reference to that and applying it to Jesus Christ. Okay, so... It's very interesting in verse 5. Hold your finger here and go to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. This would be good for you to remember should you be in a discussion with one of your religious friends. Romans 4 is a key passage. What I mean by that, it's a great passage for us as well. But your religious friends, if you talk to them about the need to be baptized, for example, they will say, you believe in salvation by works, and Abraham was not justified by works. And this is a passage that if they don't know it, their preacher will point them to. So look at Romans chapter 4, verse 2. If Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So the idea is Abraham did not depend on works to be saved. You people are saying you've got to be baptized to be saved. But if you read Genesis 26 and verse 5, what does that tell you about the word works in Romans chapter 4? What? That's true, but it defines, helps define the word works in Romans 4. What can it not mean?
Not obedience.
Can't this mean obedience? It says he obeyed. And you'll note it not only says he obeyed and kept my charge, you have three statements. He says, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. To take Romans 4 and say, well, it's not the laws of God that you've got to keep, it's the idea of just believing, is completely contrary to this. And we've talked in a previous class, I believe it was, in a sermon recently, I don't remember which, when people talk about Abraham being justified by faith, it's actually not the situation of a person who doesn't know God coming to know God. He already knew God way back in Genesis 12. He had God's promise and told him to leave his homeland, which he did. He was already a believer. It's the idea that it was a life of faith that made him right with God. And it's that life of faith that makes Christians right with God. An obedient life of faith. Works in Romans 4 is talking about you depend on doing everything perfectly. You don't need trusting in a Messiah. A Savior, a suffering Savior. That's the idea of works in Romans 4. So anyway, it's a good verse to see that the Holy Spirit, as Rocky mentioned in his prayer, guiding Moses, same Holy Spirit that was guiding Paul, and you can use one passage to help interpret or avoid a misinterpretation of the other passage. So clearly Abraham had an obedient faith, and that's why God blessed him. And we saw that way back in Genesis 18 when he explained to him why he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. So our next question down on your lesson, at the end of your lesson, is why was Isaac deceptive about his wife? And we're getting ready to read that. What was it? What? He was afraid he'd be killed. Look at verse 7. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, she's my sister. And he was afraid to say, my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. And so the same problem that his father had, he had. You have to wonder if he knew about that story and that influenced his conduct. I don't know. But what Abraham did was not approved. What Isaac did is not approved. So what this points to is that when Moses wrote this book, he wasn't trying to dress up the main characters. He said, just here's the way it is. If men were writing this book without divine intervention, they might try to cover up some of these things, but that's not the case. And there's really no comment by Moses on the rightness or the wrongness of it. But we know we worship and serve a God of truth, and he expects us to be truthful. In a previous lesson, we didn't have time to look at the verses, but I had put on the lesson when Abraham failed. Examples of others whose lives were on the line, who could have escaped danger by not telling the truth. The three boys in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. For example, Jesus Christ, are you the Son of God? If it had said no, maybe he wouldn't have had to face the cross. And so these are examples of people of faith who, when put on the firing line, did not back up and deny the faith they had of the situation that put them in danger. Yes. That's a good point, and a lot of them died because of their faith. That's right. And we see that throughout the New Testament. In the book of Revelation, we see that happening in those letters to those seven churches. And that's true, and it's a good point.
suppose that she was his sister, and Abimelech said, you know, one of us could have slept with her that would have brought guilt upon us. So by him telling them that she was his sister, basically it's like saying, well, she's not married, so.
That's the idea, that she's
so
not my wife. And remember that sister, they use these terms in a broader sense than we did. Not you use sister about in the sense of somebody who's your blood relative to your parent, but they use oftentimes these words in a broader sense. But the idea is she's my relative, which she was his relative.
So he'd rather keep his own life and open her up for risk than...
I don't know what Abraham and Isaac's thinking was. I don't know if they thought by saying that they wouldn't take her. I don't know. It's like when Lot offered his daughters. I have to wonder whether he thought these guys were so perverted they wouldn't want women anyway. I don't know that. But that's a good question, Lisa. You think, how in the world could he put his wife at risk? And I don't have the answer to that. That's a good question. Yes.
This is the same Abimelech kid from 60-some-odd years ago.
Well, Abimelech is not the name. Abimelech is a title, like Pharaoh. So whether it's the same person, you don't know by the term Abimelech. So you had a Pharaoh, you had an Abimelech. If I understand right, these were titles, not personal names. So, it's interesting, as Lisa pointed out, verse 10, he said, what is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. And so he has a concept, as you can see, of right and wrong about who you sleep with. Remember, Abraham said one of the reasons he did what he did, he said, I'm afraid there's no fear of God in this place. Remember that? And so I don't know how much Abimelech knew about God, but he had a sense of right and wrong. And men that have never seen a Bible have a sense of right and wrong. How elevated that concept is will depend upon what they've learned. But evidently there is that concept here. So, verse 11, Abimelech charged all the people, saying, he who touches this man's wife shall surely be put to death. Okay, so we get down to verse 12 following, and I ask a question on your lesson down at the end. Why did the Philistines envy Isaac, and what did that lead them to do? Why did they envy Isaac? His wealth. So you look here, it says, verse 13, the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Let's stop a moment. Is it his fault? Is it something to blame him for that he's wealthy?
No, he was blessed by God.
How do you know that? I agree with you. All right, you look at the next verse right before it. There's the answer. The Lord blessed him. So, that's the first thing. Because a person is wealthy doesn't mean they're ungodly. The Lord blessed him. When you study the book of Ecclesiastes, there are different economic levels that are referred to, social levels. And I may not be in the top tier, but there's no reason I should envy that or spend my whole life trying to get there. And so whatever your reward in life is, what God has blessed you with, Ecclesiastes says, enjoy that. It so happens God blessed Isaac, and he was very wealthy. Sometimes people who don't have wealth look at people with wealth and envy them and mistreat them and say things about them that aren't true. That's not right. And so you think it's the poor people that are oppressed, and often they are. But sometimes it's the wealthy that are mistreated, and that's what you have here. There's another thing about this particular incident. Now, the Lord blessed Isaac, and he was very wealthy. Did he bless every other descendant of Abraham with that kind of wealth, to your knowledge? No. Did he bless the Philistines that way? Shouldn't God, if he was fair, have distributed the wealth among everybody?
Isaac was special.
The idea that you have wealthy people and people that aren't so wealthy is not evil. It's not bad. But there are people in our country who operate under that principle. Today, as far as the economy is concerned, we need wealthy people for our kind of economy to work. But that's another matter. I'm just saying, here's a text that shows in a society you may have very wealthy people and people who aren't very wealthy, and that's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean the wealthy people have been oppressive and abusive to gain their wealth.
It's understanding in a lot of religious people, the reason a lot in our country why this has existed is because a lot of the religious people have professed that in the past that, you know, pray for wealth.
Now, that's a good point, Ennis. They've heard the health and wealth gospel. Is that? If you serve God, you will be wealthy. But, of course, what they mean is, I'll be wealthy because you're going to give me your money. But you're right, Ennis. That's right. That's a good point. So, verse 16, Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you're too powerful for us. And the other part of this question is, even Abraham was a man of great influence, and Abimelech made a covenant with him. And so we'll see that in the last part of the chapter. Abimelech makes a covenant with Isaac. And so before the covenant, what did this cause the Philistines to do? Stop up the wells that were dug by the servants of his father Abraham. So that's just vindictive. That's revenge. But Isaac didn't do anything to them. But envy will try to hurt others when we're envious of their position. And that's not only true with wealth, it's true with beauty, it's true with position. If somebody has a job you want or whatever it may be. And this is what envy is, an ugly, ugly sin. It's what got the apostles in prison and got Jesus nailed to a cross. And so it's a very ugly sin. So he talks about these wells here in the verses that follow. And then after that, they dug some wells that they quarreled over. And so then when you get down to verse 26, you see Abimelech and Isaac entering into this agreement, making a covenant in verse 28. And we asked this question before about Abraham. In order to enter into a covenant, what did they do? What does it say they did?
They made an oath.
Made an oath. You make an oath. You make a solemn promise. And so, we talked about this, I think it was last class. Malachi 2:14, God said that he was angry with them because they had dealt treacherously with the wife of their covenant. What is treachery? You make a promise, you don't keep it. And God does listen to the promises we make when we're married. And we better keep them. We enter into a covenant. There's more than a ceremony. That's what people are all concerned about, the ceremony. But that's not important at all. It's the covenant. And so here they entered into a covenant. So the reason I'm pointing this out, it's simply that when you go to define Bible words like covenant, it's helpful to have a text to help you understand what it is. Later this year, if the Lord is willing, we'll talk about marriage again in another class. And defining those words, you just go to different texts to tell you how those words were used and what was involved in them. Okay, so this is a covenant between men. Now, a covenant between man and God is different. God may promise. promise to do something, and it may not be dependent on man promising anything. It may be, but not necessarily. Okay.
Steve,
yes.
It's amazing to me why Abimelech comes and Isaac says, "You hate me, so why are you coming?" And Abimelech and him say, "Well, we see that the Lord has blessed you." What was in it for them making the covenant? Were they afraid now?
They said they were afraid. Back up in verse, that's a good point, Linda. Look back in verse 16. "Go away from us, for you're too powerful for us." I don't know what they thought Isaac would do. I don't know if they thought he was powerful enough to take their lands, or I don't know about that. But evidently there was some degree of concern about that. And, of course, Abraham, Isaac's father, was a man who mustered a force and led a battle, didn't he? And so while these were good and godly men, it doesn't mean they were men who lacked courage and the ability to lead men if necessary. So I don't know. That's a good question. But I have a lot more questions than I have answers. So if you find the answer, you share it with me. Rocky's got the answer. Good. Oh, okay.
It's in the text there when they make this covenant, the commander of the army is with them.
Do what now?
The commander of the army, when they make this in verse 26, the commander of the army is there with them.
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. So the commander of his army is with him.
So they thought that by verse 29, that they would do them some kind of harm.
I guess. That's what it sounds like. Or fear. But I don't know what they base it on. Of course, sometimes suspicion is destructive. It's destructive in husband-wife relationships. A person gets suspicious of their mate, sometimes for no cause at all. And brethren get suspicious of one another for no cause at all. And it's a very undermining attitude toward relationships. I don't read anything in the text as the reason they should be afraid that Isaac would harm them. Maybe it's based on their relationship with other powerful men. Sometimes we attribute what happened with other people to another person. "Well, these wealthy people mistreated me, so you probably will too." But that's not necessarily so. But I don't know the answer to that. But those are good observations.
Sometimes people judge others by their own motives.
That's a good point, Sally. Sometimes, yes, people judge others by their own, and so if I was in your position, I know what I'd do. It could be. Good point. I don't know. Good thoughts. Okay, so Esau was 40 years old when he married Judith, and we ask you the question on your lesson, what kind of wives did Esau marry? Hittite wives. And you can see the answer to the question here also. I didn't ask you the question, but you see in verse 30. Five, they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So here's a history in their culture. When Abraham wanted to get a wife for Isaac, then what did he do? Send his servant back. "Don't get one from here. And don't take my son back there." They wanted somebody that at least would be somewhat compatible with their faith. And so the same thing we're going to read in chapter 28-29 about Jacob. When Isaac wants Jacob to find a wife, same thing, go back to Padanaram and get a wife there. But Esau takes a Hittite woman. What kind of man was Esau based on what you read in chapter 25 and in Hebrews chapter 12? Godless, immoral man. He wasn't interested in spiritual things. And so, he thought she's pretty or whatever. I don't know what it was. But how it would impact his ability to serve God evidently was not a consideration. This was a concern to Isaac and Rebekah. Is it Isaac and Rebekah's fault that he took a Hittite wife? No. Parents are often grieved by the decisions their children make, but it's not necessarily their fault they make bad decisions. And it would be unfair to lay guilt on parents for bad decisions like this 40-year-old boy made. Well, if you'd have just trained him right, well, he's 40 years old. What decisions he makes is not necessarily any reflection upon his mother and father. In fact, they're very grieved about what happened, verse 35. Okay. Going back up now in our text to chapter 27. So Jacob here secures the blessing. Now what had he already gotten from Esau? The birthright. The right of being the firstborn. The firstborn received what was called a double portion under the law. Double doesn't mean twice. It means an abundant. And Jacob sought the birthright, although it was not his. We talked about this in a previous class. The text doesn't tell us, except for a possible hint as to why he treasured that and wanted that. Do you remember what we learned in chapter 25 that may indicate why he was seeking the birthright?
Before they were born, they struggled in the womb, and he had a hold of his brother's heel. And then, of course, I don't know if, you know, even at that time that he wanted to be first.
How many of you remember what happened in the womb? Huh? How many of you remember if you'd had a conflict in the womb? Go back to chapter 25. There's a little statement. And I can't be certain about this as to why. I'm just saying, all of a sudden you see Jacob in what seemed to be foreshadowed back there when they were born. But you see Jacob now seeking the inheritance. Why? What? But did he remember what happened in the womb? I doubt that. But look at verse 23. The Lord said to who?
Rebecca.
To who?
Rebecca.
To Rebecca. Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people will be stronger than the other. The older is who? Esau will serve the younger, Jacob. So she's pregnant. She's got these boys struggling in her womb. And God tells her this. Did God tell Isaac?
Don't know.
Nothing said about it. Told Rebecca. Now, in addition to that, down in verse 28... just previous to the, or involved with this event of him getting the birthright, there's a little statement made in verse 28. Does that have anything to do with it? It says, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. So Rebecca had a special attachment to Jacob. Why? Because he's handsome, because he's sweet, because what? It very well could be because of what we read earlier. Because she understood she had enough spirituality about her, and she was evidently a spiritually minded woman. She was a virgin when she married. And she's concerned about who Esau marries. And then, of course, later you read the continuing story, you see her faith. And so, possibly the reason all of this took place is because of what she had told her. Now, is there any indication that Jacob and Esau told their daddy about what happened with the birthright?
No.
Did they? I don't know. They may have. The question is, if Rebecca told Isaac what the Lord told her, and if the boys, or Rebecca, or all of them, told Isaac about the birthright, Why did Isaac proceed like he did in chapter 27? Now, maybe they did and he did anyway. I don't know. But it's possible that he was unaware of all of this and he was proceeding with what would normally be the role of him as the patriarch to bless his oldest son, Esau. So you see, that Rebekah very possibly involved in all of this previously. Now, when you get to chapter 27, and you get Jacob acquiring the blessing, who's a major character in all of that? Rebekah is. She says, "Here's how we'll do it." And she says, "I'll get some of Esau's clothes and put on you. And we'll get some animal skins and cover your hands and the back of your neck. Because Esau's a hairy man. And then I'll prepare some of the food your dad likes. Because what the dad said is, go kill some game and fix me some food. So I know what to fix." Rebekah's a key element in all of this. You say she was deceptive. Yes, she was. The fact that she was deceptive, did that make it right? No. But we've been talking all through here about the providence of God. God uses people, even in their weaknesses, to carry out His plans. This will be true in the story of Joseph. These wicked boys, God uses in His divine providence to fulfill His plan. And so, in any case, we have this story about them going through this all this work to deceive Isaac so that he would bless Jacob with what should have been the right of the firstborn, Esau. And when you read down in verse 27, 28, 29, note I have some consequences of all of this. And one of them, point number three under Jacob secures the blessing. The blessing is a preview of the history of Judah and Edom. So you have a little preview of it right here, of the years to follow. The conflict between Judah and Edom, Judah, the descendants of Jacob, and Edom, the descendants of Esau. And there was, and I have on your lesson the beginning of everlasting enmity. I don't think we're going to have time to read those verses, but maybe we will. We've got about 5 minutes. But everlasting enmity. So here's something that happened about 1800 B.C. For centuries after, there was conflict between the Edomites and the descendants of Jacob. You heard the old story about the Hatfields and McCoy. Why are you mad at them? I don't know, but I know Grandpa was, you know. And that's the way people act sometimes. My dad didn't like them, so I don't like them. Grandma didn't like them, so I don't like them. But it was an everlasting enmity, and God wasn't pleased with it. If you read those verses, you'll see that. But anyway, here are some other consequences of this. You know, the consequences of our conduct we don't see at that time sometimes. So, as a result of all of this, down in verse 46, well, first of all, what did Esau decide to do?
Kill his
I'm going to kill him. I'll wait till my daddy dies, but I'm going to kill him. He was filled with bitterness and held a grudge. And so Rebekah heard that. She, verse 42, she said, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and rise, flee to Haran, to my brother Laban. Stay with him a few days." A few days. Just stay there a few days. You know how long it was?
20 years.
20 years. 20 years. 14 years for the two wives and 6 years for the cattle, for the animals. Here's a decision. There was a family, my wife and I know, in Oklahoma, member of the church there. We'd visit with them. They live behind us, in fact. This lady had a secular job. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying she had a secular job for many, many years. What happened? Way many years ago, they needed some extra money, their bills or something. And so she said, I'll just go to work for a little while. Well, that was 20 years earlier or whatever it was. The decisions we make today better be good decisions, because we may live with them for 20, 30, 40 years, maybe the rest of your life. And that's what happened here. And then I also have on your lesson, and here's Rebecca. She loved Jacob. Because of what she did, it would be 20 years before she ever saw her son again, if she ever saw him again. If she ever saw him again. And then, of course, Esau suffered the consequences of his worldly priorities, as Hebrews chapter 12 points out. Go to Romans 9. I got about a minute or two left. Go to Romans 9. We read all of this back here, and it's interesting, but there, remember, we keep emphasizing in Genesis, there's an overriding plan that God is working out. So go to Romans chapter 9. Look at verse 10. Not only this, that is, not only the story about Abraham and Sarah, not only this, but there was Rebekah also. When she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac, for though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls, it was said to her, the older will serve the younger. It was said to who? Rebecca. Why? What does it say? Why? For God's purpose. God's working out this plan. And so, just as it is written, Jacob I love, but Esau I hated, which is in the book of Malachi. And I'm talking about the two men. Malachi, not talking about Jacob the man, Esau the man. The two nations. The Israelites and the Edomites. Because God had a plan through Israel. So when you read Genesis, we need to lift our eyes and see God's plan he's working out. And who knows today, when things happen to us, but what is part of a larger plan that God has? I don't know. I don't know. But God knows every breath we breathe, every hair on our head. That's what Jesus tells us. And Jesus pretty well knows what God knows, doesn't he? Every breath you breathe, every hair that falls from your head. My case, that keeps God busy. But he knows that. And that's a comfort to me when I pray at night or in the morning, to know God knows everything that's happening in my home and to my family, my children. And here the book of Genesis talks about this overriding providence of God. Thank you for your good attention and comments tonight. Lord willing, our next class we'll look at chapters 28 and 29. Very interesting. Thank you.